Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and the Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. And if you just go to 1517.org, you can see all of the projects that 1517 does, including daily blogs, preaching helps. We have a shop, book publishing. There's a lot going on that website. So you probably find more content every week than you could possibly
you find more every week than you can consume in a week.
Yeah, so definitely worth your time. You'll probably find a couple things you like if you already like the Thinking Fellows. And we appreciate those of you who support what we do, not just with the Thinking Fellows, but at 1517. And if you would like to start doing that, you can go to 1517.org/donate. Okay, we are on our third and final episode, covering C.S. Lewis and his work, The Abolition of Man. This is a, as we've been going through, a more philosophical work from Lewis. You know, we have covered the apologetic, sort of Christian doctrine side. Then we did literary, and that's also a lot of Christian theology that we pointed out in the Chronicles of Narnia. Now this is social commentary on the state of education, and sort of a philosophical treatise from him, all in three, you know, relatively short lectures. I'm not sure how long it would take to speak this book.
I think each one's like 45 minutes.
Okay, yeah. So it's not crazy long. And we're in the final section, which is the title of the book, the namesake, yeah, which is The Abolition of Man. And it's essentially the conclusion from the setup of the first two chapters, right?
Right.
The first chapter sets up the major problem. The second chapter sets up sort of Lewis's definition of truth and virtue. And the third is a sort of conclusion about what happens if the first chapter is applied to society versus the second chapter, I guess would be my sort of interpretation.
Yeah, it's kind of, what do you think, Adam? I think it's sort of his predictive chapter. I mean, when you read it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Michael Ward, who's written a whole commentary on this, I think it's called After Humanity, says that chapter one is a check-in at the doctor, where he's just kind of taking scope of, you know, taking the temperature of civilization or a culture. Chapter two is the diagnosis. Chapter three is the prognosis. You know, he's predicting what will be the outcome.
He's the doctor looking at you and he's saying, you have 5 days to live. You know, it's kind of,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's very much, he's looking down the path of history and saying, if something doesn't dramatically change, this is what will be. And honestly, he was amazingly prescient. You read this book and you read this last chapter or this essay, and it's kind of terrifying how much he got right.
So, Dad, you want to cover some of the predictions or the prognosis that is made for society if sort of what he has been revealing throughout the course of the book comes to pass?
Yeah, so what he's worried about coming to pass is, and you got this in the last chapter, is that humanity will lose a sense of what he called the Tao. And that when it does that, it'll start recreating that same thing in whatever image it likes, which is going to lead to a bunch of things. I mean, humanity believing that they've conquered nature when they really haven't. This is a big theme in this last chapter, and he's kind of going after scientism, right? And maybe even particularly eugenics in his time, are in his sights. He's worried that it'll be replaced by categories of power more than categories of goodness. I think he was probably right on that one too. he's really worried that once we give up the Tao, that we will make a man-made or artificial Tao, which I would say is the main theme of this chapter, which will lead to sort of like giving up humanity for a pseudo-humanity, what radical subjectivism will do, that really you'll be, that humanity will be conquested or conquered by its belief that it's, that it has conquered nature through science. Just, I mean, all those types of themes. At the end, you know, again, it's important to remember that he's worried about humanization versus dehumanization, right? But, and it's also important to remember that he's, his history with World War One and with World War Two here too, where he's literally seen some of this very personally.
And there's towards the end of the chapter, he makes the point. He goes, regardless of the government or the style of politics, whether it's communism, democracy, or fascism, it all leads this to the same destination if you get rid of any objective sense of value. Yeah. It just might take a little longer in some arenas, and it might not be as violent, or the means will be a little different in the three different approaches to governance.
I was really struck. I told Caleb I was really struck, and I think it's probably on page 71. So I'm trying to do this without getting too political or culturally political here, but let me just say that one of the things that I'm struck by in our sort of postmodern world, and I'm not like a big, I don't like postmodernism, but I'm not like a big postmodern hater in the way that, you know, grandma or grandpa probably is.
Because I think, Adam is.
Well, I think you're right to say that you want to ditch modernism too and kind of be pre-modern. And I think that's a whole different critique of postmodernism than from a modernist sort of perspective of the you know, tomorrow is always brighter than today kind of thing. That I'm, you know, in rewriting, in a real sense, rewriting history into a giant meta-narrative that continues to make you look better and better and better, you know, during the century when we managed to kill
the most people ever killed.
The most people ever killed, right? So I think I'm sensitive to that. What I'm not sensitive to is the deconstructive nature of the postmodern philosophy, that it honestly has very little to offer in the way of building, and only really has critique and deconstruction to offer.
Well,
and oh, go ahead. I've been told I cut you off, so I'm going to let you go.
Oh, wow. Well, I was trying to cut you off, but...
Can I cut you off?
Please do.
No, yeah. Go ahead.
The deconstruction is, like, interesting the first time, or for the first 5 minutes, right? It's like, you know... this will be cheesy, but we just went and saw the new Batman movie the other night, right? And the first time ever that a narrative about a superhero was written where the question is, are superheroes moral, or are they the good guys, or do vigilantes inspire a worse form of perhaps the original, and does that make it evil, was interesting.
Do the good guys inspire evil?
Yeah, do good guys inspire evil? Yeah. The first time that plot line came out, that was interesting. You know, the first time you're like, ooh, is Batman really doing a good thing, is kind of interesting. The 50th time, you're just tired.
It's like a 3-hour and 20-minute movie, like, too. So.
Yeah, and right. But this is not the first, you know, this is not the first time it's been hashed. And every time somebody asks that same question again after it's already been asked, it's not interesting anymore. Like, the speculation about is goodness good is boring after the first sort of attempt.
So if people want to know what I mean by postmodernism really only has the ability to deconstruct, go watch the Batman movie if you can sit through the 3 hours of it, because it's a very deconstructive narrative for most of it. Now, somebody will go, well, at the end, he helps save the baby from the wreckage, and be like, yeah, but you got to look at the rest of what happens. It's all deconstruction. But what I was saying is this, is that... My biggest problem with sort of the deconstruction of postmodernism, if you're going to take it just sort of on the civil level with, say, ethics and morality, is that you have a whole sort of generation of postmodernists who, whether they knew they were postmodern or not, really deconstructed the accepted ethical norms of a time, which were, for better or worse, Judeo-Christian-ish, right, in their character. I wouldn't say it's a one-to-one, but definitely there was a respect for, like, not murdering, not thieving, being honest.
I mean, you have to pretend like the population for the majority of this portion of Western history, and especially in the United States, like, created this republic, even if the United States government isn't Christian, the population that it rules over has been majoritively Christian, for its entire history. So yeah. To be like, well, it's kind of Judeo-Christian. No, it appeals to the objective ethical principles that Christians hold for a reason, because the majority of the population can be appealed to by their faith right. in this God and the faith in the Christian scriptures. And so if you want to make an argument for doing good or not doing bad in a society that's mostly made up of Christians, of course it's got to mirror the thing that they respect and hold as objective universal truth.
Right. And go ahead.
You know, it's interesting in all this you mentioning, I'm with you, Scott, on the, you know, the postmodern critique of modernity or modernism, I think is largely spot on and necessary. The interesting thing, though, with postmodernism, even though there's no, like, real definition of it, and all these postmodern thinkers would agree or acknowledge that, some of these postmodern thinkers, I think of, like, the late Richard Rorty. So I think he's been dead maybe 5, maybe 10 years. I don't know. But he didn't like being called a postmodernist. He preferred neo-pragmatist. That's really what postmodernism does when it starts to build. And for Rorty, he laid down his cards and said what his whole philosophy of teaching or pedagogy was, to deconstruct the worldview that he assumed his kids or his students came in with. A worldview, as he described it, that was fundamentalist, homophobic, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and to in its place, and to mock the parents and so on, and in its place to reconstruct a more secularist view, where that's inclusivist, tolerant, and so on and so forth. So, like,
expertism to make decisions rather than relying on parents and
right,
loved ones
right.
and that type
and,
of thing.
And I mean, that deconstructionism or the chirping critique of postmodernism, as Caleb said, gets real old real quick. Mm-hmm. But when the serious ones, though, they're in a way egg-headed revolutionaries.
Mm. Well, and they are constructing, but even their method of construction is deconstruction. So take an entire ethical system that is, like I said, Judeo-Christian-ish in its foundation that had lasted for, you know, however many years, and deconstruct it with the primary goal of continuing to build a new ethic on the basis of deconstruction of even things like, you know, physical properties of a person. And so you have, okay, the new ethical system isn't heterosexual. The new ethical system is to tear down heterosexuality in place of homosexuality, to tear that down in favor of LGBTQ.
QIA plus.
Then to tear that down to now you're going after absolutely even not being able to identify a person's gender. The point that I was getting at is Lewis saw this. I mean, if you're going to summarize kind of page 71, you'd say that he's saying that the end result of this is going to be to completely reject the Tao completely, and which will mean that humanity will be totally free to do with other humans whatever they want. Even, he points out in that page, even physiologically, right? So even with the body, like the actual body, not like the body politic, but your actual personal body, and morally. And then he says things like, they will even remake the Tao itself into whatever they want. And I think holy cow, that's what we have now. Because it, there's a valid criticism to say that a generation that spent their lives tearing down morality are now trying to replace it with an ethical system that makes no sense at all, isn't even internally consistent, and is validates its lack of consistency by continually changing and keeping, and i.e. deconstructing, and keeping people on their toes as to what is good, right, and holy.
I think one of the worst parts is that deconstructions of societies have happened throughout world history. And before, we would just call that war. And the result of a worldview represented by a country or a nation, or, you know, invading, it taking over the other, would be to not just tear down, but also just eliminate the worldview and the people and the ethics of that place they took over, which meant either likely displacing or killing those who held that worldview. One of the problems today is with the deconstruction is that we want to reintegrate and re-educate those who we've torn down back into the new system, instead of making them exiles and taking the land or taking the power from them. We then have this emphasis on re-educating, you know, taking these kids and mocking the worldview they were raised in, and then re-educating them and putting them back in the society as these new people, instead of seeing it as conquest. And it's sort of the nicety of it, right? It's like, we're not conquesting. We're just making the world better. You're just making the world a better place, you know?
Before there was postmodernism, there was Marxism. And that's the goal of,
yeah, that's right,
of,
yeah,
Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and the Communist Manifesto, is deconstructing everything from the nuclear family to education as it once was, to religion and so on, and reconstructing in its place with, you know, there's stages. The dictatorship of the proletariat is the penultimate stage until you get that communist utopia. But when you have that, you have the new socialist man, as it was called, where everything's been, where black is white, true is false, false is true, and so on and so forth. And I mean, I think, Lewis, there's things with the abolition of man, the whole book, not just the third chapter, that are maybe a little dated. But by and large, I think he was spot on, especially when it comes to the realm of morality. And I'm not talking like particulars, but our mores, our cultural mores. Yeah. And I think, Lewis, so this is like the mid-1940s. There's a guy across the pond, as I say, over here in Chicago, in fact, Richard Weaver, who wrote the book Ideas Have Consequences, where he says something like, there's good grounds to call modern man a moral idiot. Mm-hmm. And his reasoning is almost the same as C.S. Lewis. If you get rid of absolute values in as a category, let's just say, people, the judgments people make will be, or the way they act will always be self-referential. That's the classic meaning of idiot, you know, somebody who's constantly self-referential. And you fast forward to now, you know, I think of Carl Truman's book, Making the Modern Self, where he argues that in order to understand what's going on today, you need to understand that every individual human makes reality for themselves.
Right.
And that's why the ethic is changing all the time. You know, it's like 51% say this, and then a year down the road, they've changed it just a bit, and it just keeps changing and changing to meet the demands, the screeching demands of the culture war, the social justice culture warrior out there.
I think when in the United States, when polling data is done, like of a 52% majority, right? So 52% of the people can displace 48% of
the people.
Well,
even
those
majorities are even more slim in recent elections. I mean, you have, you've got literally, 49.5% to 50.5%, and the 50.5 wins.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and part of it is, I mean,
it's called the tyranny of the crowd, right?
Yeah. And part of what's been revealed of that is that
the majority,
like 4% of that population joins one side because they perceive it as nicer, right? Like the ethic of the if there's an objective principle that we've replaced other truth with, it's that we filter everything through, is it nice or mean? Is it seem nice or mean? So it's emotional calculation. Was somebody's Were the wrong person's feelings hurt? And I think that's the important part too. If somebody's feelings were hurt who has objective the Tao still. If there's somebody who still maintains the Tao and their feelings were hurt, that doesn't matter. But if there's a person who isn't represented by the Tao, whose feelings are hurt, that's how you know if something was right or wrong. Because it was mean to that person. Yeah. If it's mean to a person who historically had power or truth or reason, whatever you want to call it, then it doesn't matter.
That is the big goal of postmodernism. I mean, in actuality, philosophically, is to throw down the previous establishments of power. I mean, like Adam said, it shares or was integrated into or whatever Marxism integrated into it, because that's the goal there too. I thought it was his point around page 81, I believe, where he points out that the way that the everyday person is going to intersect the abolition of man will be through the use of language, and especially in the redefining of terms, and sort of the commodification of terms was, every time you read it and you sort of interact with things that are going on today, you're like, holy cow, man, you nailed that. And he uses things that, you know, it would be harder for us to understand today, like virtue would be changing to integration. Diligence might be changing to dynamism. And back in his days, they might say something like boys worthy of commission into potential officer material, you know. But that's a hard one for us to understand, but there's a difference there, because one is completely pragmatic and the other is about whether or not the person has made themselves a sort of valuable part of society by being virtuous, right? And one is just completely pragmatic. One of the commentaries I read on this points out that you can see this if you kind of change this up to a little bit more modern examples. Abortion is pro-choice. Baby in the womb is a fetus. You know, legal justice is social justice, whether or not that social justice follows the identified and agreed upon laws of the land. Moral formation is self-help.
Separating sex and gender.
Sex and gender.
You know, making them two different.
Virtues are not objectively virtuous. They're personal values. Sin is indiscretion.
Interesting.
Is it too early in the conversation to ask the question, so what are we to do?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you're not a joiner. You don't want to join and... I don't mean like some sort of cause, but what's the Christian as a creature of the left-hand kingdom, which has a temporal telos that ultimately doesn't matter because there's something eternal. What are we to do?
I think,
or is it too early to ask that?
It might be too early because this is where I want to go with the next episode.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Kiel's plan for the next episode is to do vocation, but I think
that's why I want to do it.
That's your only choice.
I do too. And one of the things I want to set up for the next episode with that is I actually think it's somewhere between the focusing on everything, the globalism, you have to care as much about somebody personally, a person 2,000 miles away, as the people in your living room, and if you don't, something's wrong. And the sort of problems I see with Christians becoming recluses and leaving society. I think there's problems with that as the solution as well. And so I think vocation, at least from my perspective, is sort of like the answer of how to live when you know this is all.
Well, think about it. I think about it this way. Right now, sort of just like to place this in time, if people were to listen to this in 3 years, we are, what are we, Adam, 2 weeks into Russia's invasion of the Ukraine? We're in the second week right now. So this is 2000, what year are we in?
2022.
I'm bad at this kind of thing. And everybody is upset one way or another about this, right? And I'm not saying I'm not trying to be impersonal. I'm not as emotional person as a lot of people. But unless I see a movie that makes me cry. Or somebody does something to my dog. But the reality is that everybody wants to do something about it, right? And nobody knows what to do. And the truth is, you can't, if you're just average dude, you can't do anything about this. Like, you just, you can't. There's no, you don't have a means of affecting the outcome of this conflict one way or another. You can get on Instagram and pour all your vodka down the sink. You can change the background color of your Facebook to the Ukrainian flag colors to show your solidarity. But those are all definite by, and I don't even mean this as an insult. Okay, so the people out there that did this out in podcast land, send Caleb the emails when you get mad at me. But it's, that is by definition virtue signaling. Now, that might be signaling the right virtues, so it's not necessarily bad, guys, out there. But it is, that is by definition what it is. You are signaling that you are doing something that you believe is virtuous for the sake of showing solidarity with X or Y person or X or Y group or X or Y country or X or Y president. But it doesn't affect change. Right.
And no, so, it changes people's emotional perceptions of you. It's not going to make the Biden administration do something. It's not going to make Putin do something. It's same if you put a Russian flag in your bio because you're that person this week or something, you know, like it literally just makes somebody have an emotional response when they see your name.
So the greatest thing that you could probably do that would affect some change, it's not going to change what's going on in Ukraine, but would affect some change in the world, is follow your vocation. If you're a father, have a discussion with your children, an honest, educated, frank discussion with your children about what's going on in Ukraine, what you think is going on that is virtuous, what you think that is going on that is evil, and teach them that there are categories of good and evil, and that we are seeing these play out in real life right now, and that we pray for the people of Ukraine to be protected. And that the mothers that you see on Instagram running with their babies to try to find shelter, find that shelter and stay sustained in that shelter. But you teach the people that are close to you. That's, you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
Not unless you're like going to run for senator or something like that.
You could maybe send them Bitcoin. Or
Are probably things like that that you can do that I'm
completely unaware of. If you believe, you know, if you are led that there's a certain political action that you think should be done, like on a local level, this is still vocational, though. You can start calling the representatives' offices that are actually your representatives, right? Like, instead of trying to appeal to the president of the United States, you might be able to get an email out to the congressional office in your district. You know, this is, you know, there are, but that would be, again, more vocational.
I think
in your vocation as a citizen,
you can chase this all the way up. I think even senators sitting on intelligence committees are finding it hard to figure out what they can do. Right. So if that's the case.
Yeah. What can you do?
Yeah. And that's with most of these sort of global problems that we focus so much on today. And I don't think Lewis's point was for us to focus on the global problems. I think his point was to say that these things are going to happen globally, and to be aware of them.
Because of, and we can go to back to chapter one, the curriculum that is going to change in your child's school around the block from your house. You know, like if this takes hold, it's going to take hold first in your zip code. At a school.
Yeah.
Where you can actually act.
Yes.
That's where
yes.
you can do stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a good way to do that. We're not quite at the end. And there's one other piece of this that was really interesting.
I've got one
to
more
me.
Point that I want to make too.
Well, okay. I mean, if it's about deconstruction stuff, make it, because I kind of want to move to the other part of this.
No, it's about science.
That's what I was going about to transition us to. So science. We're on the same page. He makes a comment here, and I think it's also amazing how prescient he was about scientism. And he says, a lot of people are going to read this and think I'm anti-science.
Yeah.
I'm a no-science guy.
We've heard that, haven't we?
Yeah. And that's you know, he claims that's not true.
You're a denier.
Yeah, you're science denier. And it's interesting because in this sort of, we got on the one hand, mass relativism is the one changing of language. And on the other is that somehow he's going to be denying the objective reality of science and data collection and stuff. I think he has a phrase that's like, a star is not real till we've, you know, seen it with a telescope, mapped its size, you know, probed its distance from the Earth. Like, and figured it's only, you know, becomes real like that. And thinking even on my own life, not only is scientism a problem, but the amount of data and turning everything is science. And I think on the basic level, let's look at something like a smartwatch. You know, millions of people are collecting as much data, math about themselves every day as humanly possible. Have I gone on a bike ride if I didn't measure the distance, the speed? I have a watt meter on my bike, for goodness sake.
That is so, you know, true, like, right now. We are overwhelmed with data.
You know, we live in a ski resort town. Did I go skiing if I didn't track the amount of runs?
Or if you didn't post it on the Insta?
So, you know, is everything...
The gram. The gram. The Insta. The gram.
So things, you know, this is another...
The Insta.
No, it's the gram.
Oh, sorry.
Jeez. Things aren't real until you've documented it, is essentially one of the things he's predicting here. Is like, nothing's real till it's become a data point.
For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men, reality to the soul. The solution is a technique, and both magic and science in the practice of this technique are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious. I mean, wow. Wish I'd written that.
Well, I think, in layman's terms, you could boil this down to, if you have too much information and you have the ability to alter some of that information, you will, and you'll do it even when it's wrong.
I think his point is that the prostitution of science will lead to science trying to control what it can't control about the world, rather than to describe the world.
That's right.
And yes. This will be especially true if people who don't have any regard for virtue are the ones wielding the science.
And Bingo.
Go ahead.
That's it for Lewis. It's both those things. He doesn't say this, but he's very concerned about, he uses the term scientific planning. I don't know if it's in Abolition of Man or in some other essay he wrote, but very concerned of science stepping outside of its bounds. And also very concerned with when people who do not have virtue or people who reject objective values, that minority of people use science against the majority.
Yeah. I don't think it would be, I mean, maybe it's controversial, but I don't think it'd be too outlandish to say, or too much of a political statement to say, that the COVID-19 pandemic, literally science was billed as being able to save the world.
Yep.
Time and time again.
Well,
I'll
take it to one that there's a couple things that, there are several things that we've been accused of not standing up for that we all absolutely stand against, right? Abortion. I think it's fair to say that we all believe that abortion is murder of a baby. For people that have had them and that are desirous of forgiveness for them, absolution should be granted, and counseling help should be sought and given, and the whole nine yards. So I'm not saying that, but just as a public policy, I have said many times that I think in 100 years people will look back on us in this time where the abortion of a child up to its birth, virtually with late term abortions, will be looked on as bad as the Holocaust, if not worse.
And it's
just because of the sheer numbers of children that have been killed. The other one I would say is along the same lines, fetal stem cell research. I think it's abhorrent, especially with the one of the sort of main, quote unquote, it's disgusting to even come out of your mouth, uses of an aborted fetus to collect stem cells from this. Now, this fits in with Lewis's sort of statements about science and magic, in the technique and practice of it being willing to do things that had hitherto been regarded as disgusting.
Right.
You know, in order to achieve an aim, a quote unquote scientific aim of controlling something that at the end of the day you can't control. You will never stop death before the Lord comes again. You won't. Why? Because death is the result of our fall into sin. And this result was promised by God. And you're not going to stop his promise by doing research that involves methodologies and techniques that are, in fact, both disgusting and impious.
And, well, and what it reveals is there's actually a maximum you can do before you have to do things that are evil and abhorrent to stave it off or the results of it further, right? And it actually may cause you to investigate, are some of the things that are normal now part of that? In medical practice and maintaining life.
And my biggest fear on this is this. In, to go back one more step to the changing of the language, we've changed the language so much that there people practice these positions and think these positions without acknowledging the innate sinfulness that's involved there. At 1517, we're focused primarily on the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ for sinners. In order for that to be accomplished, these people have to be preached the law first and understand that they are, in fact, sinners. The changing of the language and culture has honestly made that not impossible, but more difficult, because it takes a lot more work to just even call something that is obviously blatantly sinful. Mm-hmm. Abortion, fetal stem cell research. Sinful, you know? So, and this is connected to both the change in language and I'm not going to call it science because I don't believe it's science, because I do believe in science. I do believe in the methodology of discovery through the practice of sort of well-regarded techniques to not only derive data, but extrapolate from that data some conclusions that are themselves testable and retestable and open to change if the testing proves they need to change. That's not this. This is scientism. This is the making of conclusions that are based essentially on philosophy.
Yeah.
Philosophical rationalism.
Yep.
All right, I'm done now. Now that I bored everybody to death.
There's at least one part of what's considered science today, which is never, well, it is working from descriptions, but is rarely descriptive, which would be technological advancement, invention, and, you know, those types of things.
Well, that's one of his last points. He calls for a new science, a science that's in the context of the Tao, a science that pursues genuine knowledge, a science that respects nature, a science that enters appreciatively and respectfully into the things known.
Yeah.
Not the things unknown.
Yeah, and I think when people are dealing with something like invention, you have to see that it's actually actions based off of the descriptives of science in the proper sense within the Tao. If you learn how electrical currents work, you can use that description to then potentially manipulate those. Again, though, what's the limit of the manipulation before it's unethical? And that's why you need the Tao.
But you can use it, too, to benefit humanity in a way that's not grotesque.
Yeah, but you have to have a limit.
Right? You have to have the sense of what is good, right, and virtuous.
Yeah, and if you don't, I think... One of the things,
good, true,
and beautiful. Good and beautiful.
Yeah,
that
like because even making your life better, like something like stem cell research, that might make somebody's life better. So that can't even be your good. Improving human quality of life can't always be your good. And in the case of invention and medical advancement today, that's often the only good.
You know what? Well, we have to stop because I'm gonna. Start pissing people off. So we got to get off stem cell research because I've got mean things to say.
Mean tweets?
Things to say. Oh, okay. I mean, okay. For people that insist on fetal stem cell research to cure an illness that they have, right? So in essence, you're advocating for not only the death of, but the experimentation on human children. So that you might have a better quality of life or a longer life. There used to be a word for men like that, and it wasn't virtuous.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So The abolition of men. I think we're living in it, right?
Yeah, it really got me going. Do you mean Christmas? What are you doing to me?
You need a beer.
You're the one who went that way, man.
I know.
So what
Adam's do I like? You need a beer.
I mean, just don't drink this tequila.
I'm disappointed now because this is now like overtly depressing. And we're ending in a bad spot for this episode. If we're at 40 minutes now and our whole thing is the world is evil, depraved. No. I mean, obviously it is, right?
Give him two things. You can give him a precursor to the next show, which is going to be all positive.
I think that's true.
But secondly, this is where Lewis ends. He ends by saying this was all an argument for the absolute indispensability of the Tao. By saying you can't explain everything away. If you do, you have no ground to stand upon. And in doing so, you destroy it all. The Tao is the first principle, and without it, you have nothing. So I guess that's still negative. But it's basically an argument for just not letting go of it. And so to preload the next episode, the place where you have the most control to not let go of that with yourself and other people is with your own family, in your own home, where at least here in this country, you can still sort of say what you want.
There are places where you can maintain
where virtuous men, right, can teach virtuously.
Well, let's say there are places where you can maintain and teach truth, goodness, beauty, the Tao, whatever you want to name this.
The gospel of Jesus Christ and the forgiveness of sins.
And those are in your particular and specific vocations to other people. Yeah. And that can be, start with the family, and that can then branch out other places, but that's where you can actually do that work.
And if you're feeling down on the world, go pet your dog, because it's scientifically proven that when you pet your dog, it releases dopamine for yourself.
Science. More science.
That's good science.
Well, guys, thank you for listening to the Thinking Fellows podcast. This was our final episode on C.S. Lewis and his book, The Abolition of Man. Definitely, predictive books about the future that get right kind of are depressing, aren't they, when they get it right?
If
they're not optimistic. And the book isn't itself optimistic about the future. And so for it to be correct is sort of, it puts you in a place of, and maybe this is really good for our next episode of what now. So hopefully we can sort of do some of that on this next episode.
Sounds good.
Catch you next time.
All right. We'll catch you next time. Bye.